Or my favorite is still here's a little something off the request line from Liberty Island. We're gonna squeeze some New Year's juice from you, Big Apple. If you know that reference, then you are old enough to listen to this show. That's all I have to say. I'm just gonna redo that. That wasn't
no,
funny.
No. Leave it in. Leave it in. Leave it in.
No. Stay. Now we got B roll. I'm sitting here racking my brain trying to come up with that intro, and you know what I've done? I've just decided it's the end of the season. I'm just gonna write off that as a loss. Like, I don't need like any kind of clever intro to come into the show yet. Let's worry about that for season two. How's that sound?
I don't need your fancy intros.
All the people need to know is that I am your host, Michael Feenan, and on the other microphone is my good friend Hello. And co-conspirator in crime and development, Aaron Hill.
Hello.
Hello.
Here.
Again.
Hi.
Do Hello. It one more time.
Hello.
Yeah, so that's big news, I guess. It's episode 25. If you can do math, then that means you have been listening to the Drunken UX podcast for nearly a full year. And by the time we are done, we will have 26, and 52 divided by 26.
Wait a minute.
Means we have done an episode every single other week without fail.
Oh, I was thinking two a month, but it's not two a month. It's bi-weekly.
Yeah.
We're on like, it's like paycheck cycles.
Exactly. Yeah. You end up with that extra couple months there where you sneak one in.
Right.
So folks, this is the Drunken UX podcast. Thanks for sitting down and joining us.
Woo!
This is part one of two of our season finale. We decided to break it up into two parts because I don't really know why, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. So that's what we're doing.
That's a Christmas present we're giving to ourselves.
That really is. So you will get these episodes on the normal, regular schedule. Aaron and I will be taking the rest of the month off. You will still get real-time overview and build process as scheduled. But we are going to be taking a break, prepping some stuff for season two. And, well, in theory, you're going to be able to come back bright-eyed and bushy-tailed along with us and join us for season two starting in January.
That's the plan.
That's the plan. And, you know, it's kind of convenient that we sort of started in January, so our seasons run an even year, and we've tossed around the ideas of maybe taking some breaks in between. We'll see how that goes. I think I prefer the idea of record a lot in advance,
mm-hmm.
then take a vacation, but let your show keep running on a normal schedule.
I like that too. And I think that people that enjoy listening to the program would appreciate that.
But and we'll actually talk a little bit about that from a standpoint of production and making the time for all of this and how that happens for us. So in part one, episode 25, the one you're listening to right now, we're going to be talking about basically how this whole podcast started, you know, what went into it, and why we're doing this, and what we get out of it, and what we hope you get out of it. Episode 26, the real season, this is the penultimate episode. 26 is the definite final episode of the season in two mm-hmm. weeks. We'll talk more about the actual logistics of what goes into the podcast in terms of, you know, the kind of bandwidth we push, how we edit the show and what kind of numbers are there, you know, how we figure out what platforms we're on and all that, and tracking and things. So the technical bits will be on that episode. This episode is the warm fuzzies. I think I
don't follow. I mean, there's a few podcasts that I follow, but I don't think that the market is saturated yet, is it? Like, there's a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, podcasts, there are tons. I think the recent number I saw was something like 20,000 as of right now. It's a very long tail industry, of course.
Sure.
You know, there are probably, and I'm just going to guess here, I would say there's probably in the area of 1,000 shows that are super high-end, popular, and get enough traffic
right.
that they do podcasting for a living. Like, they make money
right.
doing it.
Right.
We've joked about it before, and we'll talk about it here, but We don't make money. we do get a little bit of revenue influx, and we're planning some ways to do some more, but this is by no means a job, and for most people it isn't.
Right.
We do it because we love it. We do it because it's fun for us.
Well, you know how, like I would say that YouTube is kind of saturated.
Yeah.
Like, getting... If you had any aspirations of starting a YouTube channel, the correct time to do that would have been about probably 6 or 7 years ago. And I feel like that's sort of maybe where podcasts are right now. Maybe my finger's not quite on the pulse there. I'm not sure, but I guess what I'm saying is that the second half of this episode airing in 2 weeks, if you have interest in making a podcast, I think that it's still reasonable to want to do.
Still, yeah. And let's actually, I didn't have this in our show notes for the episode, but I just added a note into it to make sure we talk about it, because there is an interesting discussion on that that I think will be fun to throw in here. So before we get too deep, be sure to help us out. Go check us out on Facebook or Twitter. We are at /DrunkenUX. On Instagram at /DrunkenUXPodcast. In particular, on Instagram, we share pictures of our drinks, and I'll show some behind-the-scenes stuff and whatnot. And so it's a fun way to kind of keep up. We post little updates when stuff goes out. Of course, we do that on Twitter and Facebook as well.
Yeah.
But definitely stop by, check us out, let us know how you're enjoying stuff. If you want to have a chat with us, we have a Slack. It's open 24/7. You know how Slack works, so leave us a message. If we're not there, we'll get to it. It's just drunkenux.com/Slack. Come check us out, and we'll love to hear from you. And in particular, let me encourage you, whether it's Slack or if you go by the website and use our contact form, but if you have any ideas, any topics that you would like to see covered in Season 2, please drop by and let us know. We would love to hear anything along those lines, and we'll start slotting.
We have ideas.
We're not like starving for subjects or anything, but...
But, like, we would like to give you things as a listener that you want to hear about, so... Yeah.
We've got one sitting in the tank that will probably come out in early January that has come from a listener that he said, hey, you got to think about this. And I looked at it and I'm like, you know what? That's not a terrible idea. I'm not going to spoil the surprise for you, though. My God, I think that gets us through an intro that we almost started the show without really going through the intro. What are you drinking over there, Aaron? Because this is still the Drunken UX podcast.
I'm just finishing my first glass of the Balvenie Doublewood again. It was so delicious, I had to do it again.
See? This is how it starts. I'm warning you.
Right.
One of my coworkers just Tuesday night was talking to me and was asking about... He went to a barbershop to get his hair cut. And when he sat down, they're like, would you like some whiskey or scotch to go with that?
What?
And I was like, I don't know what this barbershop is, but we need one. So he had a glass of scotch and he said, I liked it. I went and bought a bottle. I didn't like that. What should I be looking for? And so we went into this whole conversation about, you know, starter scotches and whatnot. So I thought that was just funny to me.
He didn't buy rocks.
No. no. Luckily, I don't think you can buy that anymore. I think that's long dead.
You know, I think that's there are things that happen, experiences people have when it's just a horrendous experience, but in hindsight, long after, when you're warm and safe and not hungry and not on a poop-filled cruise ship, you probably look back on it and think, like, I was part of that. And I think that the short run of that rock scotch is probably like, I had a bottle of that.
I feel like there's was a personal as awful story as... underneath all that.
I don't have any maybe I probably do, but...
They don't need to hear
I know
poop.
Plenty of... No, don't you remember the Carnival cruise ship that they were stuck at sea and the bathroom stopped working? And it was just awful.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
This was like 4 or 5 years ago.
I thought you were just talking about like your first experiences with drinks. That was like...
No,
I was like,
no,
man,
no,
you
no.
had some bad drinks on that cruise ship, didn't you?
No, I haven't had any. Well, I've had some experience with drinks, but nothing that bad.
There,
oh my god,
there are definitely wrong ways to start out with scotch. There's no two ways about that. And to counteract that, because this is this our season finale recording, I've broken out the good stuff. I don't think I've had this on the show yet. We've done enough shows now. I've started to lose track, which I think is a good sign. But this in my hand, I'm showing Aaron across our webcam so that he can see it. You can see it if you follow us on Instagram. I've already shared a picture of it as of this episode. This is the Glenmorangie, extremely rare, 18-year. Beautiful, beautiful drink. And relatively affordable for the age. When people ask, they're like, oh, well, how much is it? And I tell them, well, it's about $105 a bottle. They usually don't like that, but that is affordable for a very good scotch.
The thing to remember is that you don't do these with mixers.
No,
like chug them.
And
you like one, maybe two glasses in an evening.
This isn't going to be like the Vesper Martini night.
I'm gonna
be treating myself through this. We're not gonna get sloppy. It's, you know, drunken UX, but not stupid UX.
Right.
Okay. We made it. Okay. What did that take? About 10 minutes to get through all that. I want to talk first before we get into the stuff. You know, we always have our little opener here, and our opener for this evening is Microsoft. And this just was something that came to mind. They the other day were. Once again, like the most valuable company in the world, briefly, weren't they?
Yeah. I don't know if this is a disclosure or not, but I have Apple stock to some.
I don't think we need to disclose that.
Okay. Well, I just did, so.
Yeah.
I'll steal it.
But they had that $1 trillion valuation, and then I think everyone collectively was like, that's a lot of zeros. Let's go ahead and sell off some of that. And just bake in those profits. And then so the stock has tumbled down a bit since, not a lot, but just a little bit.
Yeah, just a little.
And Microsoft has been jumping up.
And Microsoft beat them they beat them by something like $300 million.
Yeah.
An insane amount of money. But like when you put those numbers side by side, it's... Mm-hmm. Very like they like inched ahead so slightly.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason this is important is because with Microsoft's size, with their revenue, they do things. And I want to talk about something they did, which I think is both very important and very good of them, and I certainly would encourage other companies to follow suit. Maybe not to their degree, but they donated $10 million to the Code.org organization.
Nice.
And I think that's amazing. If anybody, and I know we'll talk about your kids in just a second.
Yeah.
If you have kids and they're in school, this is incredibly important. Because Code.org is all about fostering computer science education in K-12.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for schools to do that. It's hard for them to get expertise.
Yeah.
It's hard for them to get materials and equipment and all of this stuff. And computer science is a lot. Like, it's not just programming. There are other facets
right.
to it. And so the quote, or part of the quote that Microsoft released that I loved, it said, they're also developing creativity, critical thinking, and problem-solving skills that will prepare them to thrive in the future workforce.
I think that's... I like that.
I like that a lot because it's one of the reasons why I encourage parents to... put their kids in something like debate or forensics.
Mm-hmm.
There is, and the two key words there are critical thinking. Mm-hmm. And I can hear my dog squeaking its toy in the background. I'm sure you can too, probably in the mix. We'll try to fix that later. The critical thinking piece is so important because it's hard and it requires you to do the second thing they said, which is, get people to understand how to problem solve.
Right.
And computers are nothing if not problem solving utilities.
Yeah. Well, and also problem creating utilities as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, and we were joking right before we started recording. I got these nice new Bluetooth headphones, and I thought this evening, well, you know what, I'm not going to sit with these heavy headphones on. I'll use the Bluetooth ones. I hadn't set them up yet. They're brand new. I turned on Windows, hit, you know, my Bluetooth stuff. They connected, they paired, they did all of that. No audio. I spent 20 minutes trying to get these things to give me audio, and they wouldn't.
Did you try turning it off and on again?
I promise you that I did that. I did all the things. It works fine with my phone. Works fine with my tablet. Everywhere else, they're no problem. But Windows was just like, no. But that's the kind of thing, you know, and whether it's something like that, you know, I think a lot about how many times I have to do something silly like restart my router or or something along those lines. And that's easy for me.
Right.
But even some of my smartest friends would have trouble with that because it's just not their area of expertise and they don't have the problem-solving skills to do anything but turn it off and back on again.
You know, the other day, my daughter's computer stopped working. It did that thing where the sound gets stuck on a loop, like ding, 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 ding. And it was just doing looping a half-second audio bit. Anyways, she goes to restart it, and because that's what she knows, is like, if it stops working, I should restart the computer. And so she does that, and it won't start up. And so she tells me, and I'm like, oh, well, on that one, you have to push the power button twice to get it to start. She's like, I did that, and it didn't work. I was like, okay. So I look at it, and then I look up the diagnostics on the Dell site. This is like a repurposed Dell. And it says like, oh, well, if the Amber LED flashes twice, and there's a short pause, and then two or three times, then it means this. And then it's like, oh, okay. So I had to take the thing onto my kitchen table, and then spray the whole thing out with a dust cleaner, and then it got it working again. But I mean, that's you know, years of experience taught me to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that an average person who didn't have that experience might think like, oh, well, this thing is just toast. I think it's great that kids are getting exposure to, even if it's just programming at this point, like this, that process of being like, I can do this. Like I can, this is a problem, but it's not a problem. It's just an obstacle. And I can use my brain to get over it.
Yeah. And I mean, there's just, I think it's that idea too, that it's partly because it's becoming so prevalent to our lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, this skill set 20 years ago looked very different. 30 years ago looked very different. And moving forward, you know, there's estimates, and I think Microsoft is actually one of them that's put this out, that as many as 3/4 of all jobs of any kind moving forward will have relatively technical components to it.
Right.
And it's, you know, that's not to devalue the importance of trade skills either. I think, you know, I'm a huge Mike Rowe fan, and I'm a firm believer in working with your hands as much as anything.
Sure.
But the growth in economy is towards these jobs that are going to require technical skills, even down to, you know, answering phones and things like that. So,
yeah.
And if anybody is interested in supporting an organization like code.org and doing it really, really simply and transparently, use smile.amazon.com. And you can pick a charity to have your purchases benefit. If my memory is right, and I'm speaking very off the cuff here.
Code.org is one of them.
Yeah, code.org is one of them. That's the one I benefit. If my memory is right, and I'm speaking very loosely here because I didn't plan on saying this, so I didn't double check it. But I think the announcement that Amazon put out recently was that they just passed the $100 million mark in donations to organizations through smile.amazon.com.
Wow.
So
cool.
It's a little bit like my total donations, that, you know, they're not high, certainly, but it's one of those things that in aggregate across a lot of people, it starts to add up very quickly. And it's one of those like, do a little, help a lot. So yeah. I recommend that. There are other organizations too, like Girls Who Code and some of those that are trying to do kind of the same thing, but in other niches. So this, and part of the reason this is important, why this matters, why Microsoft's donation to code.org is helpful, and I'm quoting from one of the news releases that we'll have linked in the show notes. They ran a survey and they found that 88% of teachers say computer science is critical to their students' future success in the workforce, but 60% said that computer science isn't part of their school's curriculum.
Wow.
So think about how many students that means aren't getting a critical part of what is going to be important to their future success. And
yeah,
I don't doubt that for a minute. You know, when you think about not just high-end schools, because a lot of people tend to think of education and they think of it in this model of what is happening on the coasts. But I live in Kansas, folks. I know what our schools look like, and while we don't have the population density, the middle of the country is very spread out and very small. And you have a lot of these schools that don't have, even if they have access to the physical components, they don't necessarily have access to the expertise to teach it.
You know, I was just thinking, the mandate for having this stuff available, even if you don't go into a field that requires programming per se, having just the understanding and comprehension of how it works, kind of demystifying that, it reminds me a little of when I was in high school. I took an electronics class, like a soldering stuff, and also a power mechanics class, where we had to like disassemble and reassemble a like a lawnmower engine. And I've not done anything with any of that knowledge ever since, but I understand that like how a carburetor works and how the cylinders work, and so it gives me a little bit more literacy when talking about with a mechanic who is fixing my car, because I don't know how to do it, but talking with them about what's going on. So I'm glad that I took the course, and I would hope that kids that take computer science courses in their high schools or grade schools now would find a similar benefit from that.
I would even argue that, like, I had some low-end, like, DC electronics engineering education. Nothing high-end. You know, I know what resistors are. I know what Ohm's law is. My very first real person job out of college was as an electronics technician.
Oh, nice.
Where I soldered all day, basically. And down to the point, like, I learned how to do things like, you know, solder 64-pin quad packs by hand.
Nice.
And that's, while I'm not necessarily doing that, every once in a while, something breaks.
Yeah.
A light breaks, you know, or something. Or a while back, I had a problem with my home theater receiver, and it broke. And I opened it up, and I found the problem. And, you know, that basic level of just understanding how electricity works is incredibly useful and valuable. It saved me throwing away, you know, a $300 home theater receiver, because I knew I could take that board out, disconnect it, you know, take a couple screws off, and physically clean it. Like, I was able to wash it. Because you can do that with electronic components when you don't have power attached to them.
And as long as there's no capacitors.
Right, yeah. Like I said, no power. Again, I know that, because a capacitor stores energy.
Right.
Most people don't know that. And so that chunk of skills and knowledge, you know, it is a little bit more electronics engineering background rather than computer science-y, but they are very connected. And being good and educated in one, regardless of which one, helps all of that. It helps your critical thinking, helps your problem solving. You don't have to be a programmer. You don't have to do those things, but having exposure to them is worthwhile. And having those resources made available, they said 30% of the teachers think they are underqualified to prepare students for this future that's coming.
Yeah.
Like, not even that they don't have access to a curriculum or the resources or whatever. They're just straight up saying, I can't teach them that.
Right.
And so, kudos to Microsoft. I'm glad, and I hope, right, you have, how old are your kids? Because they're teenagers, right?
No, 9 and 11. But my daughter, they had someone from the Cornell Cooperative Extension, I think, came to their school with microbits. Have you seen those?
Yeah, those are like the little, like, they got like the little magnetic ends on them. Is that the one?
I don't know if it's magnetic, but it's sort of like an Arduino, like it's a self-contained processor kit that you can program.
Yeah, and it's like lots of individual components, like very advanced Legos, right?
Yeah. It's all breakout boards. Like you connect the pieces together, they slot together, and you program them via like a web interface or something. Like they use their Chromebooks to do it.
Is that the one with like the drag and drop programming?
I have to have her show me. I don't know.
I don't know if it's Google or somebody else that wrote
Blocky.
I don't know. It's like a very drag and drop idea to the pieces.
Yeah. So my my son had a digital literacy class his first trimester of school, and they did Scratch, the MIT Scratch thing, which does the drag and drop stuff. And I don't know if you've looked at that yet, but that is cool. And I wish that we had that when I was his age, learning programming instead of doing Basic or Turtle or any of those, because this is like, it's all event based. They have different like images and sounds, and it's all like, it's really intuitive because all the blocks contain like divots on the tops and bottoms. So you can tell if the divot matches the stub on another block, then you know that they can fit together, and it makes it a lot easier to kind of assemble it. And everything is like well labeled, and if you want to, like, if you have a sprite on the screen, you can click on it and then it brings up like a multi-tabbed dialogue that shows you all the different events that you can wire up in it. And they did they have a 12 or 16 week program, and then they have like a 10 week program, and so his class did the 10 week program. And it's, the curriculum is already there. His teacher was not a computer science person. He used to teach, I think, history or something for like 15 years. And then he decided he wanted to do something different. And so he did this. And he had never programmed before. And he's able to teach it. So like the curriculum is there, and they help you through it and everything. And then the kids can program. And the stuff that he made was awesome. It was super cool.
Yeah, that is exactly what we need to be encouraging kids to work towards.
Yeah.
I know when I was young, of course, what I remember most about that though was how much I had to teach myself,
mm-hmm.
because it was something that interested me, but I was always way beyond the curve. And I'm not patting myself on the back on that. It's just that there was nothing, there was no infrastructure to it. And, you know, computer classes were literally just typing classes. I am, however, now on, and this is something I encourage you, if you work locally, especially if you're in a smaller region and not like a big city, but even if you're in a big city, I'm on the technology advisory committee for our high school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get together like twice a year. It's even, we used to meet face-to-face, now we just do it through email. But it's basically all around helping the school district understand how to build programs for kids to help prepare them for exactly this, you know, the digital future kind of thing. I had an opportunity about, I think it was a year and a half ago at one of our meetings, one of the teachers asked, well, we've got these books on Flash, should we be helping kids learn that?
Oh, God.
And I had that proud moment where I fluffed up my chest and put my feathers out, and I said, no, sir, do not teach them Flash.
But by the way, I found the curriculum. It's the Computer Science for All in San Francisco. I put a link in the show notes. You should check it out for your tech advisory committee. It's got its pre-baked curricula for K-12. Awesome. Cool.
Awesome. Yeah, as far as that goes, check it out. Look in if you want to help out in an area. It's a good way to kind of, even if you don't want to be a teacher, you can't teach a course, whatever, it's a good way for you to lend your technology experience to maybe helping a district move in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And you can recommend something like code.org to them. And they have a program called Hour of Code, which it technically mm-hmm. runs anytime all year. But the Hour of Code program is something I'll leave a link to that in the show notes as well. But check that out. Okay. I'm coughing. That is telling me that we need to get into our real subject, which is talking about us.
Yay!
What did I say about not getting sloppy on scotch? I don't remember.
This is the meta episode.
This is the meta episode.
We drunken UX, some drunken UX.
Get drunk on Drunken UX and talk about how we got here. I want to give you a little bit of background. Drunken UX is actually very old. I started Drunken UX in 2011. So 7 years mm-hmm. ago was when this idea originally started. The concept was very different, though. My original idea was to start a YouTube show. And I was going to do this thing where I put up a screen share and did kind of like the way people stream video games now. You know, you put your little box in the corner of you. And I was going to do literally drunken UX tests of websites for people. And I was going to do that as an episode. The problem with that.
I remember this.
Yeah, you don't want to, though. And you can't find any of those videos, just FYI. Yeah. So if anybody's curious, no, you can't have them. One of them I was shirtless in, inexplicably.
I don't think I remember that one. I remember the other ones, though.
So it was a neat idea. It was an idea, though, that was ahead of its time. Not because I was too good for YouTube or anything. The technology just wasn't there yet. It was too hard to do what I wanted to do at a quality level I wanted to do it. Certainly, I could have gone out and got better cameras and a higher-end microphone or whatever to help. But at that point in time, I couldn't afford any of that. And it just wasn't right. It just didn't – it was not the time. I didn't have any plan either. I had an idea, but nothing else. And I tried to run with it.
I think the concept of UX as a topic, I think, hadn't quite matured enough to where the audience was really ready for that kind of content either. Yeah.
That was real. I mean, 2011. That was
cutting edge.
It doesn't sound like a long time ago. Ooh, 7 years. But
yeah,
7 years in web terms, a lot has happened in that time. You know, a lot of studies have been done. A lot of books have been written. You know, a lot of fields have completely changed. You know, the resources we have. Node? What's Node? 7 years is a lot of time. I decided that. No, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do it to myself because in my head, I'm like, I'm going to do these every week. And I didn't want to drink that much. That would have been terrible.
Oh, my gosh.
But I kept the account. I had an email. I had the YouTube account. I had set up a Twitter account. And in particular, I kept the Twitter account because I had fun with it. It sort of became an alter ego for me. And you can go up. I haven't deleted anything off of the account. So you can actually go back in time on that Twitter account and see times where it was just late at night and I was working on something and drinking and decided it was time for Drunken UX to come out. And I would just go on weird rants. That's all it was for a long time. I always had it in TweetDeck or in my phone, and it was just an option that if I wanted to get weird, it was the place I could go get weird and talk about web stuff. I knew, you know, there was always this sort of seed that I wanted to do something with it, and I just didn't really know what.
Yeah.
Now, in the meantime, Aaron and I sort of met, but didn't meet.
Yeah, we've still not met in person.
Aaron and I have never met in person. We've seen each other plenty, obviously, at this point. But we never met in person. I'm not even sure I remember this, but Aaron, you kind of told the story to me earlier about in the Facebook group that shall not be named, we apparently crossed paths because you looked at me and thought I was a golden god, which, I mean, come on, look at
me. More like a, you know, like the bronze bull in Wall Street? More like that.
Take it. We apparently crossed paths there. He started stalking me, followed me on Twitter and Facebook and all of these things.
Yes,
we did though. I mean, we definitely for a lot of time. I mean, in between, probably. Well, I don't know when that was. What, 2013, 2012? Probably was when that
probably
started.
Yeah, probably about then.
I mean, it was a long time ago. I remember why the group that shall not be named was created.
Right.
And I think that was around that, it was around that 2012 time frame. In 2016-ish, I started getting itchy. I had switched jobs. I was not going to conferences as much as I wanted to. I started using Drunken UX as kind of a little mini outlet for my missing of people. And about the time 2017 rolled around, I started to think about what I wanted to do with it, because I either needed to use it or not.
Before that, though, was 2016 the year that I had you in the secret groups, Secret Santa?
Secret Santa, yeah.
That was, is that 2016?
I think it was. It was, yeah, 15 or 16, definitely.
Right.
Aaron got me this, the dude.
Nick Offerman, right?
Nick Offerman. God, why?
Yeah.
I have not had that much to drink, but my brain just would not give me his name. Yeah, Nick Offerman's Wood Book, which is both educational and hilarious. I highly recommend that. And a beautiful little drawn picture of a wood clamp, which is now framed. Mm-hmm. I actually have it at my parents' house. My dad is a shop teacher. And so he's got this cupboard of like all these antique tools and everything. And so we framed it and put it up with all of those.
I don't think I got a picture of that before I sent it to you, but I drew a similar one for my brother for Christmas a few years prior to that. His initials are DP, and so I drew like two C clamps, like inverted to look like a D.
Oh, nice. Through 2017, I kind of started thinking about this account, and I said, I either need to do something with it or get rid of it because, you know, it's like anything. I have too much. I'm a digital hoarder. I keep all of this stuff that I don't need. And I got to talking to some folks, and we started talking about the YouTube series, and I was like, I just don't think I could do it in a way that would satisfy anything. And I don't think I could do it in a way that would make it fun, I guess.
Right.
I don't feel like get drunk on camera and test a website is the kind of entertainment people need in 2018.
For it to work by yourself, you'd have to have the histrionics. Like, you'd have to be a really like wild and emotive drunk person,
very entertaining,
and not just like constantly face palming like that. Yeah.
We started talking about what about doing a podcast, and I thought, you know, that's not a terrible idea. Aaron found actually, and I'll throw the tweet in our show notes. Aaron found the tweet I sent out where I said, you know what, I think I'm just gonna see what happens. And so I posted a tweet about, hey, I'm thinking about doing a podcast. Would anyone have an interest in being a co-host on a show where we just get drunk and talk about bad websites? And this fool was dumb enough.
It's like two of my favorite things to do.
What's hilarious is only two people replied to me, and he was one of them. And this was on December 12th, 2017. And I say that because we turned around and launched the show in January of 2018.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
I mean, but it's also kind of on brand for people that maybe, like, you know, drinking doesn't always lead to good decisions. And so, you know, not to say it was like a Vegas wedding of a podcast, but I mean.
No, I was actually worried that I was going to scare you when we first started talking about it. And I was like, here's my pre-production document with schedule and show format and tone. And like,
if you didn't do that, I would have. I make a GDoc for everything.
As soon as I bit on it, it just seemed like such a good thing to do that I dove like full into that.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to take this, and I mean, the idea itself was something I was thinking about before December, but it didn't really coalesce until after that tweet.
Right.
And we were able to start and launch. And if you go back and listen to episode 1, I hope you listen to episode 1 and listen to episode 25 and can tell the difference, because if we aren't getting better, then what are we doing?
What one big thing you may notice is that my mic sounds a hell of a lot better now.
I taught Aaron how to talk into a microphone.
Well, the first episode I was talking to the top of it, but this is what I've learned from Michael is called a side addressed mic. Where you're talking to it from the side. And also, I had it surface mounted on my desk. Even with padding underneath it, there was still like a steady hum from my computer. Yeah. Which, I mean, Michael does post-prod, but there's only so much you can do with that.
If you know anything about audio, it's called microphonic noise. It's basically vibration that's transferred into the microphone because of what it's connected to. We solved... I mentioned before, the show doesn't make money, but we do spend a little, so we've tried to address some of these issues for the benefit of you, our avid listener. Thank you very much for making it worthwhile.
And the, In part two, we'll go into the specifics on the tech we use.
But yeah.
I now have, I'm happy to say, I have a shock mount ring, which is mounted on a stand, and I have a reasonably good pop filter. I think the total cost of all of this was under $200 easily.
Yeah, it was under 200.
Yeah.
I want to send the thanks out. We launched in January to very little fanfare. You know, our friends listened, which is the case for most podcasts. There's a whole culture around podcasting that's very interesting because so much of it is very homegrown and very grassrootsy. And I've kind of tuned into a lot of that. And so it's interesting to see that we got our first, what I would call our big break, in April.
Oh, right.
We've been doing it for about 4 months. We had maybe 8 episodes in the can at that point. I don't even know if I'd started. Maybe I had just started Real-Time Overview. The reason, and for if you're interested, the reason Real-Time Overview started was I was trying to use it as a means to keep listeners engaged.
Right.
You know, keep producing content and to provide a different kind of content that was easy to listen to, you know, something very short.
Right. Well, remember back like when blogs were a thing, you know, the common wisdom was to have a regular posting schedule, be it daily or weekly or whatever, but have it on a regular basis so that your people who at the time would have been using RSS consume it, kind of expect, you know, your distributions on those days. So I think it's sort of along the same lines, right? Like,
yeah,
we couldn't produce this every week without going crazy and burning out. But
you stay on top of people's minds, then, so to speak.
Right.
And thanks to Smashing Magazine, we got on top of a lot of people's minds.
Yeah.
Smashing Magazine featured us in an article in April that, it like quadrupled our listenership overnight.
You know, if you came here from Thanks Smashing Magazine, thank you.
Yeah. If you started listening, and actually, to our listeners, if you started listening to us as far back as that April, and you found us there, let us know. I would just be interested to hear that you're still here and that you're enjoying it. What fascinated me about that, and I said it at the time, was I was like, this is awesome. Look at these numbers. You know, they're huge. It's, you know, we've talked about the hug of death, the slash dot effect. This was very similar in the world of podcasting. But I cautioned Aaron, I'm like, this is amazing, but I'll be interested to see what it looks like in a couple more episodes.
Right.
Because I was waiting to see what kind of attrition happened and what the drop-off was for people coming just to see what we were about. And the shocking thing about it was we never dropped off.
Yeah.
We'll go into more numbers in the next episode, but like if you look at our analytics and our stats, like we not only held it, but we have been growing ever since then. And that to me is like, that's the best part about it all, because it means that we are putting out something that people enjoy and are staying for.
It's really neat when I would hear from people that I know personally who just happened to mention that they caught one of our episodes and that they really liked it. And I mean, yes, it's people that I know, but I don't think that, like, they would go out of their way to say, like, oh, hey, I caught this and I really liked it. They didn't have to say anything. They could have just said nothing, but they did. So I don't know. It's just, it's really cool to be like, oh, that's all. That's so great. We made a thing that people like.
This is our love letter to you. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being a listener, because we do pay attention. We see the stats. We watch Twitter. We look at these things. We're in Slack. We are thrilled that you enjoy it, and that's why it's also very important to us to know what you want for season two, because that stuff will factor in.
Yeah.
Talking about 2019 and beyond, and I mentioned earlier, you started talking about YouTube, and I thought that was interesting, and I threw a note in here to make sure we didn't just skim over that this idea of, like, it's hard to get into YouTube as an amateur of any kind now without some kind of very different or provocative content. The one that's going to come to mind immediately is the hydraulic press channel, because it's very specific. It's a very high level to entry area. It's not like it is not high quality produced. That doesn't mean it's not high quality. Let me be clear about that. Right. I watch it. I know about it because I enjoy it. It's fun.
Right.
But if you look at a lot of the YouTubers, and you know, if you watch anybody, like, let's say Markiplier, we mentioned in our last episode, folks like Grace Helbig, a lot of the gamers now, guys like Cage848 and Parsley Royal and some of those folks, the quality of those productions has gone way up.
Yeah.
And for them to put out that that content requires a, you know, I can't meet it because I don't have the equipment they have.
You've got to have like an HD camera, like a Canon HD or whatever that can do HD video. And you've got to have a green screen. You need to have either After Effects, Premiere, or what's the other one? This is a good video software.
I use OpenShot for what it's worth.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know about it, but open source.
Those people are using other ones. Premiere is the one I hear about the most often.
Game streamers in particular, like the good ones, also have dedicated streaming machines connected to their gaming machine so that the two don't fight for resources.
Right.
And like on the content side, even like think about somebody like the Fine Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not familiar, they're the folks who produce the React series, Kids React, Elders React, and all that.
And tried to patent it.
Yeah. We forgive them. Think about somebody who has come along like CinemaSins.
Yes.
Doing everything wrong with.
I've never tried to say that out loud before. Holy crap.
CinemaSins?
CinemaSins.
Honest Trailers.
What's a synonym for CinemaSins?
You know, the point being that the level of professionalism on YouTube in order to be successful is incredibly high. And that's not to say you can't be a small-time YouTuber. You totally can. But I think it's a lot harder to tap into an audience there now. If you want to go, if we wanted to do this show, or if I wanted to go back and do Drunken UX the show.
Yeah.
I think I would have a very hard time doing that and attracting an audience over all the other stuff there because of volume, the amount of stuff that's created, and the quality of the stuff that's being created at the top end.
YouTube launched 10 years ago, right?
2006, right?
Okay, so a little over 10 years.
I think.
I think 10 years ago, you know, you could realistically, and I remember seeing people that did this, they would just use their cell phone cameras.
Yeah.
They would use their smartphones, they would have the YouTube app, and they'd record and then upload directly to it. And, like, there would be no editing at all. It would just be, like, vlogs from their cell phone. And that was, like, acceptable content, and it is not the case
anymore. And now they're using Canon D5 or 5Ds with Rode microphones and soft boxes in their office. And, yeah. And podcasting is sort of in that. It's right in that transition phase. You still have this super long tail of homegrown content.
Mm-hmm.
The lucky thing is it's relatively cheap still to produce good quality content.
Yeah.
But you are starting to see organizations moving in, and this is kind of what has happened in YouTube, where you're getting a lot of sponsors, a lot of organizations built around making content for YouTube. And so in podcast, you know, if you've listened to, you know, folks like Gimlet is a good example. You know, you've got these organizations that saying we're going to make our market in podcasting. And so they are scooping up a lot of that high end production quality. We're not there yet. But it's I see that coming where depending on my God, go into Reddit and go into the podcast or podcasting subreddit. And do a search for the phrase "true crimes."
I've heard. I know someone that works on those.
Oh my God! The number of people who want true crimes podcasts, want to make them, is incredible.
Yeah.
In less of a quote-worthy phrase, two guys who get drunk and talk about movies and pop culture. I'm not saying that's us. We're close. I like our niche.
I think we're more niche than that.
That's the web development angle gives us something, but that idea, because when I started this in 2011 and started this idea, that wasn't a thing. And when I started running with it, in fact, I think I even found at one point a podcast. It was dead, but it turned out to be very similar to what we were doing with Drunken UX. And it's like, man, you know, that idea. There are no new ideas anymore.
Right. Well, you know, what we were just saying earlier, though, about what the expectations are with the workforce and with jobs and what the school should be doing with computer science and all that. I think that a lot of our content is pay service to people who are getting into this. And so with that being part of our audience, and if you're part of audience, like, let us know. But
the thing that makes me happiest about it is that I go back to that tweet from December, and I just pulled it up, and here is the exact thing I said. And on that topic, does the idea of a drink and rip on bad web design podcast collab appeal to anyone? I could not be happier that that is not what we do.
We did for the first two episodes, I think.
And we had, like, we've had those episodes.
Yeah.
But that, I feel like, is not what the Drunken UX podcast has become.
Right.
We aren't just two guys getting drunk and ripping on bad web design.
Right.
I don't mind, like, you know, the weather episode or the car dealership episode. Like, those are fun, and I think they absolutely have a place. But it isn't the audio version of what I was thinking for YouTube, and that's kind of what I was describing there.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, it's cool to not be afraid of that kind of growth and change throughout.
You know what, though? Those episodes that we do, even though we are kind of just, like, ripping on bad web design and things that we think is like, oh, ugh, you know, but it's not just Schadenfreude. And I think that in those episodes, we come around to some really good insights that I think is potentially useful for people, whether or not they're in those industries.
God, I hope so.
I think so. I there's things that I learned that, you know, that you find and that I find. And afterwards, I'm like, I learned something from this. Like, this was for me personally, it was a positive experience.
Which segues nicely, actually, because I do want to talk just quickly about why we're doing this, right?
Yeah.
Because for me, it was about, like, looking for that chance to stay engaged. I mentioned how I was at that point where I was like, I need to either do something with this or get rid of it.
Right.
And I wasn't traveling as much. I used to speak at conferences not just once a year, like several times a year I was traveling to talk places. But because of my change in job that happened in 2012, my focus changed, and so I wasn't doing that as much, and I was starting to miss that. And so I viewed this as a way to sort of stay engaged with a broader community.
Yeah.
That was a big part about it for me. I don't know if you just saw a tweet and thought, that might be cool.
It was a little bit of that. It was a little bit like, I've never done this before, and this is something I enjoy doing, and it seems like it would be fun. That was about the extent of it, and, yeah.
I found it really hard, too, because, like, I used to use writing as an outlet, and I still try to once in a while, but as weird as it sounds, and we'll get into this towards the end of the episode, that it was really hard for me to just set aside time to just write something, you know, write an article or a tutorial, and I think that I come across better in audio than I do in writing, although one of the best compliments I ever had, I do playwriting on the side, for those who don't know, which is probably most of you. And I had somebody reading one of my shows, and when they came back to me with feedback, one of the best compliments I've ever gotten was, they said, I can literally hear your voice in my head as I'm reading this. I guess I just have that, that quality, but I enjoy it. I love writing stuff. I love putting tutorials out there, but at the same time, for some reason, it's just hard for me to commit to.
It's been, I still have a blog up. It now has 16-point font. Thank you, Tatiana. but I haven't, I think the last time I even logged into it was to update, well, I mean, to do updates, but also to change the font size. Like, I only log into it whenever I have, like, a discovery or something that I want to share. But I think a lot of times I forget to do that even. I used to blog pretty regularly. Like, I would say almost weekly. But not so much anymore.
And so did I. Well, I used to be on .edu Guru. I think we've mentioned that before.
Yeah.
I have a backup of the site, because as I need stuff that isn't out there anymore, because the site's no longer there, I go back to it and I pull those articles so I can reference them for folks. But I had like 100 articles on that site over the course of 3 years. So, yeah, I mean, it's like 3 articles a year. Maybe not. I don't know.
Okay, so my strong suit. This is a tangent, but so on this the secret group that shall not be named, there was a photo posted, and I don't remember who posted it, but it was of like two small rugs, maybe like 5 foot long by 2.5 feet wide, and then a couple cans of beer, like all just laying out in an alleyway. And is the random thing. And then from that, I wrote a very short one act play. And then I put it up on a Tumblr and I put the link into the show notes. Yeah. okay.
Well, you know I'm going to read that.
Yeah, well, it's on brand, I think, because it involves two people who are drunk ostensibly at work and then one of their coworkers discovering them. it's a short read.
it's a good example too. Like, this show scratched an itch for me, which is that yeah. I'm very busy, and I'm a theater guy. I majored in theater in college. I also worked on two radio stations prior to this, and so I have a performance engine in me, so to speak. And so I saw this kind of as a way to get back into that a little bit on my terms without all of the overhead. Like, if you've done any acting of any kind in, you know, community theater or something like that, you know that those shows take, you know, weeks of time. Mm-hmm. Every night, and it's hard to commit to that when you've got other obligations. So this gave me a way to kind of address that need. I think a big thing for us, and I mentioned before, I did some pre-production planning for the show and everything, and one of the themes I kind of decided I wanted to bring out of this is there's nothing wrong with making mistakes. And that's not talking about you or anything that other people don't. It's about literally Aaron and I.
Yeah. It's literally my motto. I have a print that I bought from Jay Roeder. He's a graphic artist. Link in the show notes. And also Image. I have a print of that. It says "Make Mistakes," and it's hanging in my bedroom wall. Because, yeah.
And what is it? It's good Facebook advice. Right? Move fast and break stuff.
Yeah.
I prefer your version. So. Move fast and break shit. But
that's what you said in the. Is it stuff or is it shit?
Well, I think he said stuff because, I mean, that was a corporate thing. So okay, I think that was Facebook, wasn't it? That wasn't. No, Google was something else.
Google was Do No Evil until it wasn't.
Yeah, that's right. and I like that motto because, and we've stressed this many times, Aaron and I are not perfect people. We are not perfect developers. Mm-hmm. We are not like unicorns by any means. And I view the show itself as a chance to learn as much as anything, whether that's learning from our guests. Mm-hmm. I'll throw back to the episode with Greg Podunovich and design theory. Man, I learned so much coming out of that episode because I'm not a designer. Yeah. That's not where my strength is. And so that chance to sit down and talk about that concept with somebody who is so deeply rooted in it, that gives, I hope you learn something as a listener. And I definitely did.
Definitely. The one about Gutenberg, too, was very informative. I had no idea that was even coming around because I haven't been staying abreast with WordPress news.
One of the things it gave me a chance to do was I've been using Gutenberg now for like 4 months, 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
The Drunken UX site is now powered by Gutenberg and has been. By the time you listen to this, Gutenberg will have actually released. We've already recorded. It's releasing tomorrow by our calendar. But it gave me that chance to sit down and say, you know what? If we're going to talk about it, I should definitely be using it too. And sure. So it's pushed me to do things like let's put Gutenberg on our website and put our money where our mouth is. You know, episodes like Real Time Over, shows like Real Time Overview, you know, have pushed me to make sure I'm constantly reading and always keeping up on different bits of news and tutorials and all of this. And so in a way, this has been, even though this takes a ton of time to make and produce, it also has encouraged me to use the rest of my time a little bit better in service to what I want to create, which I think is part of why I did this, I guess. It's why I keep doing it. Let me put it that way.
Sure.
I think I wanted I wanted to do it just because I like entertaining people.
I hope we do that.
And we've talked so much, and I love the phrase, you know, talking about imposter syndrome and this idea of comparing yourself to people. And the more we do this show, the more I enjoy. I remember, so we sat down in episode, I don't know, 18, 19, somewhere around there with Chris Wegman.
Oh, right. Yes.
And talked about computer security. And I remember him at one point saying, I hope you don't mind, but that, you know, let me back up on that because what you just said wasn't exactly right.
Right.
And he was so worried that he was going to offend me by contradicting what I just said. But I was like, but
right,
no.
Right, because we're the hosts. Yeah.
I love that because I think everybody benefits by seeing folks who are like, yeah, you know what? We're smart. We have problem solving skills. We have critical thinking skills. Where do those phrases come from? But we're not perfect, and that is okay, because what makes it okay is you have to be open to listening to other folks and gaining that stuff. And when somebody's smarter than you, you know, not smarter than you, but better skilled than you in a certain area says, well, wait, your job isn't to defend yourself. Your job is to say, oh, okay, well, wait for what? Tell me what I'm waiting for and figure that out. And that's true in any industry.
I think for me, there was a real watershed moment for me in my career when I think in the earlier years of my career, I felt a lot of imposter syndrome and I felt like I didn't know as much as other people. And so I felt very defensive a lot of times. And I think I would take feedback like that a lot more personally. And then there was a point at which it just sort of like flipped for me. And I was like, became okay with accepting, I don't know. Like, I don't know these things. And so when people would point, when I would make a mistake, I'd be like, oh yeah, I screwed up. Look at that. Or when people would say like, hey, did you know you could do it this way? I'd be like, oh, that's awesome. And it became a lot more receptive and I learned a lot more and I could really see my competency and my knowledge that I knew grew so much faster once I was able to accept that I was, you know, down at the bottom of not knowing things and then had a lot of room to learn.
You know, there's always this stereotype of, you know, the homebody programmer who lives in his mom's basement eating Cheetos at a computer and doesn't go out in the sun.
That's the dream, right?
And not the dream. That, don't listen to Aaron. He doesn't know what he's talking about. How's that for criticism? It's, you know, these stereotypes exist for a reason. And I think it is because, without going way philosophical, our industry is simply very male-dominated. It's still very prevalent that there's a lot of not good social skills present.
Right.
And I think it's on us to try to fix that. And I think a lot of that does come from exactly that, that there are people out there who don't take that criticism well, but they're never given that opportunity to flip that switch and become the teacher or the person who says, oh, wait, I see now why they were giving me this information. We have to break that trend. And that was part of why we started Build Process. We've talked a lot about this. Aaron and I talked behind the scenes about it. I was talking with some other folks who were interested in being involved with the show. And Build Process grew out of that idea and just the general growth of the show, that I talk to people, I work with folks who are smart in ways that I will never understand and I will never be able to reach. And I love listening to them and figuring out how to do what they do. But they are, you know, a few people in an organization that is very large. And the work, the real stuff gets done in the teams of 6 people, 10 people, where those people aren't unicorns. They're just fucking good at what they do.
Yeah.
And
they've put in the hours.
They put in the hours, but they're receptive to criticism. They understand. They know what they're not good at. And I think that especially for people who are learning and for people who are coming up in our industry, they need to see that that is so, so okay.
Yeah.
Because there's just the horizon is so wide and there's so much out there that you can focus on. and that you need to. You need to focus on things to be good. But being good at some things comes at the cost of not knowing other things, and there's nothing wrong with that.
I learned recently about this term, you know, paraprogramming, right?
Yeah.
So I learned about a different one called mob programming. I think that was the term. I'll find the thing. But it's essentially, if paraprogramming is with two people in front of a computer, mob is with greater than two.
That sounds a lot like exorcism. Not an exorcism, but like the site exorcism.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
No. That goes down a whole weird road. That's not what I meant.
But it's how much nicer would it be? Like, it's easy if it's just two people and you're, you know, like, you feel like, well, I have to be either the teacher or the learner, right? So which one am I? If I'm not teaching, I must be the learner, which means I don't know anything. Oh no, I'm a failure. They're all going to find out. It's easy to fall down that. But if you've got like three people, all of a sudden, like, you know, there, you could be the teacher or you could be the learner, or you could be like the nebulous third person, and maybe you're that person, and that can be a little bit easier to sort of ask questions and admit you don't know things, because there might be other things that you do know. And I don't know. I like this idea, and I just learned about it today. So it's a neat thing I'm looking to learn more about.
So one of the things that we've had problems with, for instance, just to put everything on display, is we have had several problems with guests.
Which I think you should rephrase that.
Yeah, which isn't to say that the guest was the problem. In fact, to everybody who has
never been the problem,
been on our show, I appreciate you. And to those of you who have suffered through our problems, Jeff, Greg, there was a third. Who was the third? Oh, Chris? Was it Chris? I think it was Chris.
Yeah.
There were at least three, I remember. Recording, if you don't know, I'm in Kansas. Aaron is in New York. Our guests are wherever the guest is. So we can't record together in person.
Right.
And that means mistakes happen. Usually that's my fault. and we have had, the mistakes have ranged from software not at all behaving in a way that good user experience would define, to Michael forgot to hit a button. And they have been so gracious to, you know, be patient with us and come back on and re-record what we've already done.
Well, one of them wasn't your fault. We were using YouTube Jeff. Live that time, right? Yeah.
And Jeff, like, was the first one that went wrong.
Yeah, and you would like you had started it and it was working, and then like you like stopped and restarted, but when you restarted, like, it didn't automatically record your feed. What?
Yeah, that was live. Jeff. That was Jeff, because that was the one where I was using the multi-track input, and when I restarted it, the application I was using it reset all of the input tracks to defaults, and I didn't know that. And so when I did that, because I have an external microphone that's all fancy and nice, it comes through a different input.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so that was the other one. I think it was with Greg, was the one where we restarted, and I had started the recording. We had to restart it for some reason, and we got into it. And my brain, I remember even, I think I lifted up my clicker. I have this clicker I use to cut us in and out. And I went to hit it, and I think something distracted me, if I remember right. And I didn't go through all of the motions, and there was some muscle memory involved there. And so since I didn't do that, I didn't hit the record button a second time. And you've heard, if you've listened to past episodes, you've probably heard us make those sort of veiled jokes about, you know, doing this again or whatever the case may be. And it's a case where this isn't web work. This isn't building a website. It's media production, but there's no harm in acknowledging that. And my biggest fear has always been that somebody would get angry and be like, I can't believe you wasted my time. And that's why I say, I'm so thankful to those folks who have taken that time to come back on.
For real.
But those oopsies happen, and they happen in web development as well. God knows. I remember launching Google Analytics. This was in 2006, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think it was still Urchin in 2006, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we launched it and broke the entire student portal for the entire university because we put Google Analytics on our site. Oops. and in those situations, yeah, it sucks. You issue a mea culpa and you fix it and move on. And I don't feel bad about that because preventing it would have required me to know things that I couldn't have possibly known.
Yeah.
It had to do with cookies and the way a third system was consuming and distributing cookies. It was so weird and bizarre and fringe. I don't feel the least bit. I love that story, as a matter of fact. And it's okay. I think that's the other, that side of imposter syndrome and all that, that I don't care if I make a mistake because I learned from it and I didn't do it again. We fixed it and we launched Google Analytics. I mean, that's how you should react.
I do feel badly about wasting our guests' time. We're not wasting it, but requiring more of their time than we should have. And hat tip to the guests we've had that were so patient with us.
The advantage to that is, like theater, hey, we got a rehearsal in.
I will say that every single one of those, the second recording was far better than the first.
No offense to anybody else that we've had on.
No, none. I mean, I think, those were the first, three that we did, and so...
Really early.
Yeah.
So I think we kind of figured out, what works and what doesn't, but... I remember for the Gutenberg one, the first run-through, I kept making, and I never used the word Gutenberg once. I kept using other German words each time, and I had a list in Notepad on my computer. Of various German words.
Here's my big secret. We didn't really fail that episode. I just said that so that we could re-record it without that. Don't tell Jeff. Speaking of Jeff, just real fast, I want to give him a shout out because while this episode is coming out in a few days, Gutenberg will still be very new, very freshly released. And if you are still getting ready for that or trying to think about it or prepare for it, they just on WordPress Weekly, and I'll throw a link in the show notes for it, WordPress Weekly just had Matt Mullenweg on, so literally the day before Gutenberg is dropping, he sat down, chatted with Matt, and they went over a ton of stuff. And so if you if you have any concerns or thoughts about, and for better or worse, about Gutenberg, you owe it to yourself to go listen to that episode of WordPress Weekly. So we'll link that. Give Jeff a shout out, WordPress Tavern, WP Tavern, for taking the time to do that. Because it's big. This is a big update. Let's see. We've got one more. I've got one more topic I want to talk about, and then let's get the hell out of here and let people get ready for their holiday. I want to talk about setting aside and making the time for the show, because I said earlier that I didn't have time for writing, but here I am producing a podcast that is currently doing in the area of 7 episodes a month. Yeah. And I still say that I don't have time to produce this, to do all this. And
yeah,
I won't even lie. We'll talk about it in the next episode. Our production schedule will be changing because of it. But setting aside the time and making the time, I think, is an important thing to think about. Whether you want to write or build websites or do graphic design or make a podcast or make a YouTube series. Like, for instance, for us, I had to think about setting aside the time just to make a website.
Right.
Aaron, you have a website.
Yes.
Is it yours, or do you just use, WordPress or Medium? Or
a long time ago, it was hand-coded, and... I was happy with that, but then writing new content into it, I was like, I might as well just do it in WordPress. So it's in WordPress now.
Do you have your own server, or do you use a Bluehost or?
Oh, I use DigitalOcean.
DigitalOcean. So that's what we do. Same thing. We went with WordPress. Our site's WordPress. We made the choice to go with a premium theme just for the sake of expediency.
I think it makes sense because we're serving podcasts. Most of the normal themes aren't podcast oriented, and I think the one that you picked for this, I think, works really well. Like, I really like how the player fits right in the top. Really easy to find, and I like how the content fits.
It's for what it's worth, there actually aren't a lot of options in the podcasting premium theme realm.
Right.
That's not to say that there's anything wrong with our theme, although I do know, and before anybody tells me, I know there's a CSS bug on narrow screens. I'm going to fix that. Throwing that out there. So we went with the premium theme, and I'm using a plugin called Seriously Simple Podcasting. There are a couple other fairly large players, and I went back and forth. But, you know, I said early on that I was going to set aside that time to build that site, and There's this problem, and it is true with my blog, Aaron. I think you would agree. The cobbler's children don't have shoes.
Yes,
you know.
Yes,
this problem of when I was talking to somebody who worked for a newspaper recently, and they love writing, and they have I forget what it was, a story that they were looking at, and I was telling them, well, why don't you turn it into a book? And they're like, I write all day.
Yeah.
I don't want to go home and write more. And yet that's what we do so often with web.
Right.
And I will be the absolute first one in line to tell you, I know our website has problems right now. I know my blog has problems right now. Because it is hard to say after working all day building websites that I'm going to spend all night working on websites.
I still love the... For in the transcript area, how we have it looks like a text message conversation. That is something that we wrote. We created that. That was not part of the theme.
That is our custom development.
Yes, and I still think that is awesome. I'm totally patting us on the back for that. We rule.
And to go with that, like, I've done some work on the side too. I've made that time. We put this show out on YouTube now. We've got a tool that puts out a nice little, like, waveform-y kind of interactive video. I do custom images for our cover images, but also for Twitter at different sizes. And it's like all of that takes time. And I think, again, regardless of what you're thinking about doing, you know, making time is... important part of that, and figuring out ways to streamline that. So I have template files set up for a lot of this. I found resources that make it quicker. Our choice to go with a premium theme was all about expediency. And we'll talk next show about our future goals, and making our site better is among them. but also, like, we set aside time to record, obviously.
Speaking to that, I think that if you are wanting to start a podcast, don't worry about making your site perfect initially. Just make it work and make sure you're collecting data. You're not going to lose anything as long as it works and it's serviceable. You know, focus on just creating the content, because that's going to be the lion's share of your time.
But finding the time to record, you know, we set up times in the evening, usually, to sit down and record these episodes. We have a lot of time that goes into writing notes ahead of time. Editing time that has to come into all of this. Scheduling with guests when that comes up.
Oh, right, the editing. I totally forgot about the editing.
Editing takes hours in some cases. Yeah. Recording, that process of recording is something that, again, you just kind of, you know what you're getting into. And I say that not because I expect everybody to go out and make a podcast. I say that as somebody telling anybody else who wants to do something. Think about...
create content.
Yeah, you can't just think about your outcome. You have to think about the process that goes into it.
I think I'm grateful that, with the exception of the times when we've had to do re-records, we haven't had to do multiple takes. And so, you know, in the hour 20, roughly, minutes podcast, the actual recording is probably only hour and 45, hour and 50 long. But we still have, you know, like, Michael and I will typically connect 20, 30 minutes beforehand, kind of run through the show notes, make any additions or subtractions, and then talk about like some points we want to cover, and then we usually like chat afterwards while I'm uploading my audio to his server. And then, you know, Michael mentioned doing the editing, which he does. I did it for the build process number 2 for an RTO episode that I filled in on. But I think you typically do the DUX episodes.
Yeah, and I... Yeah.
And the post-prod, too.
Count myself lucky a little bit there, because that's my radio background coming through that...
Yeah, you're like, you're more skilled with those things.
Yeah, like I'm used to editing. I know what audio editing is like, and you know how to master a track and all of that kind of stuff. So that has definitely come in handy in this particular case.
Right.
But it's the kind of thing that I hope it makes a difference for folks. I hope that you notice that the extra time that we have put into that. But even if, let's say you're a painter, you know, maybe that's what you do on the side. I can only imagine what has to go through, you know, preparing the colors that you need and the mediums that you're using and, you know, the canvas. Maybe the canvas type has a certain kind of cotton quality to it that absorbs paint differently and causes it to dry differently. Make sure whatever it is you do that you take the time, it's that pre-work that really helps the post-work so much.
In painting, as someone who does do painting, I will say it's actually the polishing is where you'll spend probably 80% of your time. You know, getting the initial thing down is, you know, that takes time. But then the perfection and the quality actually comes out during, like, you know, the polish and the detail and the finessing and all the stuff that might, in recording, I guess, might be like post-production.
What are the areas where I think we've failed miserably on that front is putting the time aside to transcribe.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I remember there was a tweet out there of me telling someone that we would prioritize this because it's important, and it is super important to both of us.
But it's hard. And we will go so in depth in that in the next episode. So if you're interested in that piece, be sure to stay tuned. But to me, and I'll take your painting metaphor, my painting metaphor, you metaphor,
sure.
I don't know. the painting metaphor. It's kind of like you paint the picture, but you rely on somebody else to put the mounting brackets and wire on the back, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it's like you could take that extra time to do that and do it the way you want it and make it right, or you just assume somebody else will. And that's kind of where transcription fits. And it's one area where we really have failed our listeners. And it's the kind of thing, let's go all the way back to imposter syndrome and admitting mistakes and all of this, that we know that we aren't doing a good job of that, and we're hopefully going to take steps to make it better.
Yeah.
Time is a huge component of that. And along with that is promotions and making sure that, you know, the show does nothing. If we have no listeners, we can't do the show.
right. And well, I mean, so, we can. It would just be screaming into the void.
Yeah, exactly. And that's no fun. And I tell folks, you know, if you're going to do a podcast of any kind, do it for the love of your topic.
Yeah.
But for a lot of folks, that's not good enough. And they're always asking those questions about, well, how do I get more listeners? How do I do this and do that? And you do have to do a minimum amount of promotions, whether that's paid advertising, search engine optimization, whatever. We spend a lot of time, you know, I try to do Instagram now. We don't have a lot to show. You know, it's microphones and computer screens and cover images, but I try. We do YouTube. We are working on the website and we do those things, but everything we've said in the last 15 minutes are all time sucks that whether you're producing
ancillary costs that
That
maybe you don't think about when you think, I'm going to make a podcast.
Or make anything. You know, again, I don't want you to think of this lesson as a lesson in how do you make a podcast popular.
Although, that said, I would say that the number one priority above all of this is to first make good content that you're happy with and that you feel like delivers what you want to deliver. And then worry about the marketing and everything else, because like if you have a shitty product, it doesn't matter if you're great at marketing, you know,
You gotta be passionate, and you have to believe in what you're selling.
Yeah.
I've been building websites for, my God, over 20 years. Too long. I love my industry. I love what I do. I love the company I work for. I'm fortunate to be able to say that about all those things. And I hope that some of that is absorbed by everybody else too, because that's why we're here. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Thanks for listening this week. Folks, thanks for that. I don't know. Boy, we're in trouble because we have another half of this episode to record and we're doing it right now. And boy, I'm already a little bit tongue-tied.
I think it's a good way.
We're going to roll with it.
That's an on-brand way to close out the year.
That is an on-brand way to close. I agree. Thanks for listening. I am your host, Michael Fien, and Aaron Hill is on the other microphone. This has been Drunken UX Podcast, episode number 25. We are rounding out the season finale. This is part one. And stay tuned, because in two more weeks, you're going to get part two.
Yes, be sure to connect with us on the Twitters, @DrunkenUX, and also on DrunkenUX.com/Slack, and on Instagram /DrunkenUX Podcast. We have photos of stuff. You know what? We were talking about electronics earlier. I soldered together. I get the HackerBoxes.com monthly bundle, and I got a little kit with picks and audio.
Show it off.
I will. I put it on my Instagram, but I will put a picture of it or a video onto the DOX Instagram, because it looks really cool.
We need.
Yeah.
That's what people are craving, baby. Folks, even though we are recording this all right now and we're getting ready to go on vacation, you will get episodes throughout the rest of December as scheduled, because we just care about you that much. So Real Time Overview will be on Wednesday, along with a build process episode. I think that's on the 12th, if my memory is right. If it's not the 12th, it's the 19th. But either way, I hope you listen.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I only got one other thing to say. And until next week, part two of our season finale, we say, keep your personas close and your users closer. Bye-bye.